Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? How's it going? You all right? Is my tone too chipper for the pandemic situation? How are you taking it? How's everything with you? How are the kids? How are you holding up? Are you surprised? Is supplies okay? And like just a little bit of a hello to the people that are by themselves again. I hope you're all doing okay. I know there's some people that are trying to stay sober out there and they're getting into the online meetings, I guess, on the Zoom app, which I need to get. Stay in touch with people through this, friends, family, check in as much as possible. There's no reason now not to text or call or FaceTime or Skype or Zoom your mom, your dad, your close friends. It's important when there's a lack of ability to sort of touch and hug and socialize, to do it somehow. It's important for people to listen to people, to talk to people, to feel like they're part of a people thing. If you don't do that, people start to lose their fucking minds. And certainly if you're putting the wrong shit into your brains while you're isolated, you're going to lose your fucking mind. I mean, it happened to about 35% of this population for what different reasons. But isolation is something that existed before this. There are a lot of people most of us are isolated in terms of how we live our lives in a way, or else our worlds are fairly small. I mean, there are people that have always worked from home. There are people that didn't have jobs to begin with who are shut-ins and at home. There are people that didn't even need to buy food because they'd stocked up on chips and soda, and they're still, they're locked in a room, spewing garbage online. That was before this. But isolation is a real problem. I think it's one of the issues that so many people that we know, and even people that we think might be intelligent, can't quite wrap their brain around what's happening. But it's happening. I mean, I'm guilty of it, man. I mean, I'm not out in the world pretending like nothing's wrong, but I'm having a hard time wrapping my brain around the real destruction and pain and death and everything else and the lack of supplies and the hardships that people are going through because of this thing, because I'm sitting in my house, I'm alone. You know, I read stuff. I got an email last week from that woman in Italy. But there's all of us live these sort of isolated, insulated lives, even when there's no pandemic. And just to have a consciousness of this thing. And, I'm not being sort of, it's not apocalyptic thinking. It's not overreacting. But we're in it, man. And I can't be too glib about it, but whew. I just hope people are taking care of themselves, and more importantly, reaching out to people any way they can that have been in their lives, just to throw a line, connect, say hello. And I'm going online, I'm doing stuff. I'm playing my guitar on Instagram. I'm trying to. It's not even have a life. I mean, there's a lot of what's happening now that used to be the way I lived. As a young comic, you just sit around, write, and think all day and play guitar and nap and cook food. And I guess the point of this is, I talked to my buddy Dave, and he was freaking out. He was in a rabbit hole of, symptoms and statistics and who gets what and what are the outcomes. It's bad, but you can't just sit there and defeat yourself. Do what you can do in the moment that you can do it for yourself and the people around you. And don't make it worse than it already is. Just understand the reality, understand your part in it or your place in the world, and try to live your life and be ready to be helpful or to run. Right? Where, though? Huh? Where do you run from the bug? Dan Aykroyd is on the show today. And he's like one of these guys about, you know, about the aliens. The aliens here. It's a coronavirus. These renegade strands of RNA looking for a partner to helix with. Ourselves. They're just, they're not full bodies. They're just, they just need to be full bodies, but they can only do it with ourselves. Virus. Virus. Also, sometimes the foundation of some relationships. I'm not a whole person until I glom onto you and use you to be a full person, to replicate myself and leave you a drained husk. Dark. Dark. Right? Dan Aykroyd is on the show. He was around, so I got to talk to him before the shit went down that to the point where we couldn't leave. We don't know really what's going to happen in terms of that. I read the order from the LA Public Health Department about what is and what isn't essential businesses. And in the media realm, podcasts are okay, sanctioned, essential. So, you know, we do have some episodes, some interviews in the can, which we'll keep using. And I think I've got one or two interviews set up for the near future, but I can offer a fairly safe space, just me. And I'm healthy and I will sit 6 feet away from you. And I have spray and wipes. So if you come by yourself, we're good. We're golden. So we'll see what happens. If not, if people aren't going to come, we'll figure out another way. We'll figure out another way. But panic. So I had some panic. Everyone's having panic. Do we have it? Do we not have it? Am I just a carrier? Do I have it and it's not going? Is it not showing? Well, the testing, I don't have exact information on how they're prioritizing that, but it seems to be people who have been around people who have confirmed it. And I don't know. I just know there's not enough of them, and it's a little chaotic, and it's hard to stay isolated, but want to, you know, check, you know, what if you need to go to the doctor? I know, but I've had panic. I've woken up like, why is my chest fucked up? Why is my chest heavy? Why can't I breathe right? And then I realized like, oh, that's what happens when I panic. But I also realized, as some of you know or remember, when we had a sponsor here that Everly Well did the food sensitivity thing, and it happened to be all the foods I was eating at that time. Like I had a high sensitivity to egg whites. I had moderate sensitivity to almonds and yogurt and kale and cashews. Like all the healthy shit I was eating, I had sensitivity to. And right a week or so ago when this all started going down, you know, the stockpiling, storing food, I was like, fuck it, man. You know, I'm not really allergic to anything. Those sensitivities were bullshit. I'm going to get kale. I'm going to get almonds. I'm going to get cashews. And sure enough, for the last week, I've had a little tightness in my chest. And guess what's a symptom of allergies? Yep. Got no fever. Got no other symptoms. And I didn't eat almonds or any of them yesterday, and it feels better. And I've been hiking, but it is where I feel stress as well. You can manifest symptoms with your brain if you commit with panic and fear, and your brain, you know, you can focus and manifest almost all symptoms. So don't fuck your head like that, all right? Try to relax. I've been writing a bit. Actually, not so much. I've been cooking a lot, and I've been watching some movies I haven't seen, catching up on series, watched a Cassavetes movie last night, playing guitar, spending time with my cats, and talking to you, and doing shit around the house, and hoping for the best, but it's definitely a scary time. Definitely a scary time. And I had this thing happen, and it's been happening, and I need to fucking put it out there, and I don't even know if I can explain it properly, to be honest with you. Because it makes me nervous. I don't know what it is or what to do about it. Okay, I'm going to try to lay it out. Because I tried to talk about it on... Tom Sharpling came over and did a an episode of The Best Show in my driveway where he threw a cord out his window and I hooked up one of my mics. And Lynn Shelton and myself, me and Lynn Shelton, however the proper way to say that, Lynn Shelton and I don't know, stood outside his car and did an episode of that. And I tried to communicate exactly what I was feeling to describe this phenomenon that's happening to me. It has to do with my phone and my brain. Okay, first off, I guess, like, have any of you had a genuine out-of-body experience, like a near out-of-body experience, where you may not have gotten far and you may not have gotten all the way out, but you just all of a sudden have this a strange consciousness of your body as something other than you, I guess is the way to put it. Like that you kind of like your brain sort of has a consciousness of the fact that it's just housed in this thing that moves. And that's the sort of feeling, you know, obviously the brain is in charge of the thing, but there is, because the self is housed in the brain or somewhere like that, the self is sort of like, wow, I think I'm just going to cut loose here. Do you know that feeling where yourself tries to cut loose from the body, from the vessel, or gets a little distance from it, even almost leaves? Well, my point is that that's the feeling I'm getting sometimes when I look at my phone too much. If I'm just in my phone, I'll all of a sudden realize like this, like that my body is separate than me. My brain and self is connected with the phone and somehow my hand is holding it, but I've got nothing to do with that. Does that make sense? It's happening a lot. There's a sort of disassociation to it and it's sort of creeping me out. It's sort of like, this is the singularity. It's happening to me personally. Can anyone, is that making sense? Should I be concerned? This is no time to go to the doctor to try to explain that phenomenon that I just tried to explain to you. Now, is it? No. All right. Well, look, Dan Aykroyd, he's always promoting his Crystal Head vodka line. He's also back as Ray Stantz in the upcoming Ghostbusters Afterlife. But he was one of the guys. He's one of the original guys. He's one of the original SNL guys. And this is me talking to him.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Are we gonna roll here?
Sure, yeah, let's do it.
Well, let me know, because I can formally let me say acknowledge where I am.
Sure.
Yeah.
We're on.
I love your location here in Culver City. thanks for sending the golf cart. You know, I'm just across the road here at Sony at Ghost Co.
Yeah.
The Ivan Reitman administered Ghost Co.
Yeah.
And it was great to be so close to the studio and get over here that way. Thanks. We took the tunnel from the old Sony Columbia Tunnel, the one that Harry, Mayor, Louis B. Mayer had.
Yeah, sure.
And we took the golf
cart. We tried to make it convenient for you.
Oh, wow, it was so great. I love that. And then you come here, and it's the old film tower right at Culver City. So we went up the elevator, and here we've got a beautiful view of the city, and what a spot.
Yeah, isn't it great?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's you're the first guy to actually admit where we were. And I try to keep it a secret, and I appreciate it.
I'm sorry. I knew this a satellite to your real location, which incidentally, folks, I couldn't get to because Mark came down, you know, to see me, and I was going to go up. But you are in a missile silo in...
Yeah, that's right.
I think it's North Dakota.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is, you know, I come out here occasionally to interview people, and they let me use this. This is the only location I'll use.
I love the missile silo. You know, my brother and I were to buy one.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, man.
Yeah.
There's no missile in it, but...
No,
but it has the whole, the tube and...
It's quiet. You know, it's nice down there. You know, we just got refrigeration working on a steady basis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was all battery run initially.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is where some of us have to be in the world if we're talking about things that matter. It's great to be with you, man. You know,
nice to be with you. You know, you got a lot of papers. You come prepared. You broke it down. What do you got on the papers? What's the plan?
First of all,
seems like you plan more than me.
You're a great interviewer, and you know, you interviewed Terry Gross, and
I did.
I just kind of was curious because she got me to reveal secrets about myself. You know, she has that voice.
Did she really?
She did. Yeah. You know, like, you know, that I eat worms or whatever.
Eat fried worms?
Well, I don't know what I revealed, but you know, she really gets you to talk about yourself, and then you're introspective. And you forget she's there.
She's not there, though.
She's unbelievable.
She's usually on a satellite. You didn't sit with her, did you?
No.
You're sitting by yourself?
She put the hypno coin on me, and
it's very hypnotic. Yeah. And if you listen to MPI, you're very used to her. Uh-huh, you're comforted by her her presence in your head.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's happening.
Did she come into the studio?
I did a weird... not a weird gig, but it was when we did a live gig.
Yeah.
And she chose me. She said she would do this radio. It was a radio benefit, I think, show. And she said if I interviewed her, she would do it. So it was actually live in front of about 2,000 people that we did it.
Yeah. Oh, neat.
It was tricky. You know, it was tricky because she's not really that type of show person.
Yeah.
And to sort of keep it candid and figure out a way in.
Yeah.
But at that point, that was several years ago. And I think it's still kind of like that. People know very little about her, so you could find a way. Mm-hmm. You know, there was gaps in the small amount of information that was available that would sort of like, what happened there?
Mm-hmm.
You know what
I
mean? Yeah. What
because
else you got
she
on the papers?
She's buttoned up, you know, but you she's a great man. You know, I think she's buttoned up on the radio, but she's a master broadcaster.
There. Oh, no, she's great. And it seems to me that your life is, you have a sort of weird, deep respect for broadcasters.
as a veteran of 26 years of House of Blues Radio Hour, and my persona is Elwood Blues, forgive me for the cheap Chicago accent, but really, you know.
Sure.
I'm an adopted son of that city, so I can do it from there.
Yeah, of course.
Elwood was on there on the radio. We had the House of Blues.
But when you were a kid, it must have, like, something about it must have planted the seed or wired you that way.
Well, I don't know. My dad gave my, he was 98 yesterday.
Congratulations.
My dad is an old engineer there, and I used to watch the black and white television, the Ud Sullivan show.
Yeah.
And so my dad one day, they chopped off the top of a hockey stick.
Yeah.
And he took a black electrical tape, and he made it into a microphone. He put a little cord there.
Yeah.
Made it into a toy microphone and gave it to me. And I started to imitate announcers and that when
so
I
So that's when it started.
It did, yeah.
You were fascinated.
I love the voices. I loved all the impressionists that were on those shows.
Could you do Ed Sullivan?
I don't know. Too many people will remember this next gentleman who's been on the show so many times. Of course, tonight we have Wayne Schuster. You know, he was a gossip columnist.
It's close to Nixon, isn't it?
Down in here, yeah. And I could say some profanities, but I'm not.
You can. You're allowed to here,
Mr. Presley. So good to have you in the White House today. Imagine when him and Elvis met. You know,
good to be here.
But it's just great that you're going to help with the drug effort. tonight, Topo G show.
Yeah, Topo G
and the Flying Relentless. He was a gossip columnist, and there's a famous movie. You know it. Called Sweet Smell of Success, Tony Curtis,
right,
and J.J. Hunsecker, played by Burt Lancaster. Ed Sullivan was the basis for that character.
Was it? I thought it was the other guy,
Walter Winchell. Walter Winchell. Both of them were kind of muckraking gossip scandal guys, but they parlayed their careers. Winchell into a columnist, of course, very influential, and then Ed Sullivan into the variety show host. Now, when Winchell's memorabilia sold, no one bought it.
Oh, is that true?
Did you know that?
I had no idea.
His hat, his typewriters, his pencils.
No one gave a shit.
No one bought Walter Winchell's.
No one cared,
what's
Dan.
What's that say about a tabloid reporter's life?
It means people thought he was garbage.
Walter Winchell had a spectacular voice, and you'll remember it from...
In 1932, Elliot Ness and his Untouchables raided a warehouse on the north side of Chicago. Frank Nitti was caught in,
Mr. Ness, and of course, Robert Stack.
But when you grew up in Toronto?
I was born in Ottawa, Canada.
Yeah.
And I am a Canadian through and through. And here's how Canadian I am. I was born on July 1st. That's Canada Day.
Yeah.
That's the Independence Day of Canada when we became a dominion of the crown. I was born grandson of a Royal Canadian Mounted Police Staff Sergeant.
Did you know him?
My mother was French. I knew Eddie very well. And my mother was French-Canadian, and my dad was a high Anglican Englishman. And so...
So he wasn't from Canada?
He was, no, he was from Toronto, sort of a WASP. So it was kind of the French-Catholic WASP marriage. French-Catholic marries a WASP.
Grew up Catholic, though?
I was raised Catholic. My dad converted for my mom's family.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I was at my dad's baptism there, him kneeling there, and also his confirmation.
That's a weird
moment. The bishop slapped him, yeah.
Weird moment?
Remember?
Yeah,
it was a weird moment.
The bishop slaps you even as a grown man?
Confirmation, yes. Yeah, you get the whack, you know.
Really? I didn't know that.
Of the bishop. And as a little kid, you get the whack from the bishop.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
And that's sort of like welcome?
Well, yes, because, you know, you're being, now the Holy Ghost is visiting you when you get that whack. You know?
Oh, okay. Right.
And some see the Holy Ghost. As I do today, I see the flame every day.
Every day.
Every day, I see the flame. But my dad was a very interesting man. He was an old kind of engineer, road engineer.
What does that mean, road engineer?
He built highways.
Okay.
Yeah, he built highways.
So he was out in the world with the navigating.
Bulldozers. He blew the top off of Granite Mountain. Mm. And I watched him do that as a kid. You know, had a great upbringing. So I'm very Canadian. Born in Ottawa, capital city. Grandson of a Mountie. French-Canadian mother. High Anglican WASP father.
Brother, sister.
I have a brother, Peter. Very funny. You'll know him out there in the world as the Java Junkie. Do you remember that clip from SNL?
Yes.
Do you remember that clip?
Yeah.
That great performance as a guy drinking coffee.
Right.
The film by Tom Schiller.
Yeah. Schiller. Is Schiller still around?
I believe so. He's a director. He does all kinds of stuff in commercials and short films. He was so brilliant, you know.
So
my brother's a Java Junkie. Yeah. So I'm Canadian. I was born in Ottawa.
But the Catholic thing, how religious were you brought up? Pretty strict?
Let me say, I went back as far as being an altar boy that I had to get up at 7 and 8 years old. I was getting on a bicycle and bicycling to the church and serving Mass.
Mm.
And then I went into, I was actually hodwinkled to go into a seminary. I went into, I attended St. Pius X Minor Preparatory Seminary for Boys in Ottawa.
And were you thinking there about doing the thing?
Well, the interview was very interesting. We were with Father Lunny, a great priest and a great mentor.
Uh-huh.
And my mom and dad were sitting there with me, and Father Lunny looks at me. And my dad and mom wanted me to go to this Catholic school, not go to the public school. And he looks at me and says, Dan, so you are here. You're considering a vocation here. You'd like to join us in our calling, and here's my response in front of my parents and Father Lonnie. Well, and I see my mom wants me to go to the school, and my dad would relieve him because it was on the way to work. He could drop me off. Yeah. You'd like to be a priest. So we did three years of that, and it was a good upbringing, and I learned a lot, and there were some terrific people there. At that school, between 58 and 78, St. Pius had all boys there, and there 5,000 of us went through there. Guess how many became priests out of 5,000?
400.
Two.
Two people?
Two people.
So it was just a school. It was just an education.
Well, it was an experience, you know. I was pretty Catholic there.
But you believed. You believed.
Well, I believe in the cosmic engineer. I believe I didn't buy a lot of the hoogie boogie, but I think that the words of the Christ and the lessons
the
of Christ can be. Yeah, there's some hoogie boogie going along with
any centuries religion. Of hoogie boogie. I think my question, though, when I was thinking about you coming over, was that I realized that if you have the foundation of believing, the ability to suspend your disbelief and believe in God at any point in time in your life, it kind of makes you vulnerable to believe in just about fucking anything.
Well, here's the thing. People do believe in anything. Catholics believe in the Virgin Mary. The Mormons believe in the Angel Moroni and the golden plates and the magic spectacles. The scientists believe...
in the underwear.
They believe in, yes, and they believe, the Scientologists believe in Xenu, the super god, and, in the Hindu religion, there's a belief of Vishnu. So what my approach to it now is, okay, believe what you want. I am not here to question what you believe. If you believe that there was a zinger up in the sky that hit the Virgin Mary and caused Christ to come into the world, and I'd say I'm a fan of Christ. I really am.
A zinger.
If that zinger was true, then, and you believe in that, fine. It's up to people to have their own beliefs and not for me to question, and really not for me to be questioned on my belief as a spiritualist. I am a spiritualist.
That's an old title, spiritualist.
Well, it comes from basically the 1800s.
Was it and theosophy? Was it a Blavatsky thing?
She definitely was a part of that movement. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's a belief that not only does the energy of the soul survive, but the consciousness survives after death.
We're surrounded by him. Many consciousnesses.
I think so. There was an old, I got you my dad's book here, History of Ghosts.
And it was sort of interesting to me that you come from this, it's like centuries.
Since my great-grandfather Sam was a dentist and he started exploring this stuff in the 20s. And in the book here, it talks about a guy named Arthur Findlay, and he was a medium in England, and he was very good at it. He brought Channel forth many, many entities, and he used to go to the theater, and he'd be sitting in the theater, just try to watch a movie, and then all these voices would come from where he'd been channeling, and the people around him would go, shut up, man. He brought the entities with him. I thought that was a very funny story.
But I've been here sitting with you for 10 minutes, and I've heard at least a dozen entities.
Best one is
July 1932, Elliot Ness and his Untouchables. Rico, Rocco.
You know, that's a good entity.
The best one is Robert Stack, though.
Yeah. Lee, Rico, bring around Unsolved Mysteries. A man walks down a beach. A pebble hops up at him. Who's inside the pebble?
You're channeling.
I loved him. Now, we've lost a great man in Hollywood recently, Kirk Douglas.
Yes, 103. Too young.
Too young. My dad's 98, and he goes to me, no more. Kirk and I shared a movie set. I was honored to have made a film with him. John Asher directed it.
Yeah.
John Asher is kind of Hollywood royalty himself. You know, his mother was Elizabeth Montgomery, and his father was a producer and writer, and John directed this film.
What was it?
And it was called Diamonds. And Kirk played, it was about, you know, the sundowning syndrome in Alzheimer's. And I played his son who had to put him in a home eventually. Oh. But there's a scene in there where he insists on driving, you know. Mid-90s. So he sits in this car and he said, I'm going to drive this scene. And he was, and he'd. Great stunt driver.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
On purpose?
Yeah. I wasn't scared at all. But what a pleasure. My dad came on the set, too, at the time. So to have the two of them sitting
5 years apart, you know, having a good time.
Exactly right.
So, okay, but the spiritualism and the channeling and also the idea that we don't question others' beliefs, but you would question others' beliefs if they had dangerous intent or violent intent.
Sure, of course, absolutely. I mean, and boy, there's enough malevolence in the world that we should be questioning what's going on, you know.
Yeah.
Have you read this book, The Uninhabitable Planet?
No, but I feel it coming.
Yeah.
How much do I need to know?
I don't know, but in our time, it was the bomb shelter. I mean, I'm a little older than you.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I was in primary school, and I'm sitting there, and I put this in the Blues Brothers, by the way. They showed up one day, and they put up an air raid siren, you know, right, a pole right there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was the one that was on the top of the car.
And the funny thing is, in retrospect, they would have not been helpful at all, really.
No. Because by the time an ICBM hit wherever it was, you'd hear
it's over.
It would be
done. An ongoing.
We lived under the horror of that, the nuclear horror.
Sure.
You know, and so that was what we were living under. And then there was polio.
But you know, with the nuclear horror, you know, there was just there was at least a human element to it in terms of like someone's going to push a button. And with this environmental L thing, it's sort of like I think the button's already been pushed, and no one's going to take their finger off it. So it's different.
This guy's saying we reach close to 2.8 degrees, and you know we're going to see planetary rises of 10, 15 feet in places. And so I think you know the real estate industry should be really on board with this. Miami, New York, they're talking about the seawall in New York. They've got it figured out in Rotterdam.
Yeah, get the beachfront property in Nevada.
Or 32nd Street, too.
So you're in Canada. You're not going to be a priest. When do you start sort of getting involved in the comedy?
Well, how about grade 10, grade 9, grade 10, grade 11, class?
Yeah, sure.
You know, in class, there's me and another guy there. Yeah. No, that was bad. And then I did plays and I did sketches and stuff.
You
and,
did sketches?
In high school and throughout high school. And in college I was in a performing group and was, you know, one of the minor players.
What group was that?
It was at Carleton University, which is a very good university in Ottawa.
Do you know any of the fellas that was in the group with you now?
I haven't seen them. They went on to great careers
as
directors and there were many good actresses there. Went on to great careers in Stratford and Shakespeare up in Canada.
No kidding, because I didn't realize, like, I was recently shooting a movie in Hamilton.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that town.
Well,
I love the Hammer, man. Wow. Great people there.
When was the last time you've been up
dead
there?
Dead infrastructure. You know,
But I didn't realize there was
thriving bar scene.
There's a thriving something scene.
No, it's cool.
They're trying to come back around.
Interesting.
I was there. There's a pretty big film industry that's spreading throughout Canada.
Of course.
And Hamilton's made itself available for those dicier shoots.
Were you playing a steelwork?
No. I was playing a record A&R guy, a PR agent.
What's the film? I'd be very interested
to
see that.
It's about David Bowie's first trip to the States.
Oh, neat. Okay.
Yeah. Wow. It should be interesting. It's a small movie.
Who plays Bowie?
Bowie is played by this guy, Johnny Flynn, who is a popular English songster. I recently played Jerry Wexler in a movie.
Oh, yes. No kidding. I knew Jerry, of course, because he was, when we were at Atlantic with Blues Brothers, I knew
Did
Jerry
you,
and Ahmet and Nesui.
And they were all alive then.
Yeah,
was that, the 80s?
I knew Ahmet good. I knew, Ahmet.
But Jerry was more like this, right? Jerry talked this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. You're great. Wow. So that's fun, man, playing parts like that. I played I played James Brown's manager in Get On Up.
I remember. Yeah. I remember. That's right. You were kind
Mark,
of, But the reason I brought up Hamilton is I had no idea that it was such a big comedy sort of source. Mm-hmm. I mean, didn't Ivan Reitman go to
Marty Short?
Yeah, they all
Eugene
come from
Levy.
There. Right.
Eugene Levy, Marty Short. Marty Short's brother is a great writer, of course, and Ivan Reitman.
Yeah.
All come out of the, yeah.
And I had no idea when I was there. I was sort of like, this place is falling apart. But but then people were like, it's got an amazing history.
It does. It does. Well, the university is very strong there. And
But you didn't go there.
I didn't. No, I went to Carleton. But I like the Hammer because, you know, I love dead technology. And
dead technology?
I love the look of it.
Rusting vats?
Yeah, cinematic.
Yeah,
you know, cinematic look. It's great.
You know, have you been there? I performed out there at... it's a place called the Steelworks in Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
which was
Bethlehem.
Bethlehem.
They turned into a mall.
Yeah, well, it's actually an art space.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and you perform, and behind the stage, it's all windows, and there's the dead steelworks there.
Bessemer furnaces.
And they light them up.
That's right. They were, of course, those were Carnegie's furnaces
and
Phipps and those guys.
So you're fascinated with dead technology.
I'm also fascinated with the Industrial Revolution and just, how fast it's gone from coal and coke and rail steel production, like 1880 to now.
Yeah,
how fast we've heated up the planet, and I think that's what fascinates me is the speed of
that,
and the speed of innovation.
Sure,
too.
And it's so exciting that we have other nostalgists who are currently in power that seem to think that coal is a good idea again.
Well, you know, there is a way to do it.
Yeah.
And the way to do it is you've got to have a scrubber on there that just eats up all of your profits. So you're providing energy to the consumer and you're burning coal to do it, but there's no profit in it. You've spent it all on your scrubbers. Now, if there's a company that's doing coal out there willing to do that, to go out there and spend all of the money so that it's clean, still in business for the consumer, but any profit that's out of it, goes to keeping the scrubbers going. I think it could be feasible because a lot of countries need power.
Yeah, yeah, and nuclear power scares you. How do you feel about it?
I'm mixed on it. Germany has removed all of the nuclear plants. We have a leading environmental cause advocate, Bobby Kennedy Jr., saying, you know, nuclear may be a choice. Mm. We do have it in Canada. We've never had an accident. Three Mile Island was an interesting occurrence. Then Fukushima, pretty bad. Chernobyl, you had cows dying in Oregon
from the fallout. Did you watch the show? Did you watch the series?
What a beautiful piece of television.
Wow, no kidding,
acting,
man.
And everybody was
fucking
perfect.
Incredible.
Oh, just beautiful.
Yeah,
just beautiful.
Man.
I love that.
So,
I love that. That was so great.
So you're doing, when do you meet Lorne? Like in Canada.
I saw you, you interviewed him. Well, in 1960...
Did 2 days with Lorne.
Did you? Yeah, well, pretty fascinating. One of the, probably the greatest impresario of our time.
Yeah. But and, I mean, you knew...
St. Michael's College, University of Toronto.
Uh-huh.
That's Lorne. I went and... went to the CBC with a friend of mine and a partner, Valerie Bromfield, and we went together. We had written some material as a team, and we had a cable show in Ottawa.
It's my belief that any talented person, if you stay in Canada, will eventually get a show.
A government sponsored show.
That's what I mean.
So that's what we were looking for,
a
government sponsored show. We showed them we had a show called Change for a Quarter. It was 15 minutes of comedy. We brought the tape in. It had a handle on it. It was a full inch wide videotape, like the size of, it was a foot across, a full inch wide and a handle.
Mm.
That's how big. So we brought that in and showed it to a few executives, and they said, well, you know, it's not really our kind of thing here on this floor, but downstairs there are a couple of guys putting together a new comedy thing, and it's new people, and it's young, Lauren Michaels and Hart Pomerantz. So we got an interview, and Lauren hired Valerie and I for a summer TV special called The Great Canadian Humor Test. So in 1969, I still wasn't out of college. I was still at Carleton. He hired me that summer to play old men, basically.
Yeah.
I don't think in one character was over, you know, was under 40 in that
show.
So
what was your impression of him, like, immediately?
Loved him immediately. The brilliance, the wit, the fun, the sense of being guided by a true mentor with massive knowledge of, you know, the TV comedies of the 50s.
Oh,
Of the Catskills.
And what was Hart like?
Hart was funny. He was a lawyer.
Oh,
yeah, he was funny. And Lauren had shoulder-length hair and a Zapata mustache.
Uh-huh.
And Hart was, and they did an act together. And one of their components was the Great Canadian Humor Test.
Right.
And Valerie and I were on there. So that's when I met him. Then a couple of years later, I'd been at Second City. And
you were at Second City?
I was at Second City.
In Toronto?
Yep. 70, 71, 72.
Who was the crew?
Radner.
Yeah.
Candy.
Yeah.
O'Hara.
Yeah.
Levy. Jerry Salzberg was brilliant. Rosemary Radcliffe. Martin Short was in around there with the Godspell Kids, the Second City and Godspell Kids. And so the kids from Godspell kind of migrated over to Second City.
And that was the first production of Godspell.
It was
pretty famous.
Yeah, that's what. Now, when I met those kids, I was driving a mail truck, and I was on the radio at City TV. Lauren got me that job as well.
He did? But you weren't working for him?
Not at that point.
What were you doing on the radio?
I was a shot box announcer, you know, doing like fast rap kind of announcing, you know.
That's part of your blood.
It was. I worked for Moses Neimer at City TV. I was a game show announcer and a commercial announcer.
In 69?
71. And then I drove across country in 72 in my Slush 6 Chevy Biscayne.
Yeah.
And we drove from Toronto to New Orleans to Tijuana.
Who?
My friend John DeVicus.
Yeah.
The artist who designed all the Ghostbusters stuff.
Yeah. Still around?
He's still around. The Viking. Yeah, he's good. We drove across and we stopped in L.A. and Lauren put us up at his suite at the Chateau Marmont.
When he was out here writing for
Lily Tomlin and Laughing.
Yeah,
and he said, "Dan, I'm going to reinvent the live television of these 50s."
He put you up at the Chateau.
He put me up in his room and
sad prophecy.
And we were there and John and I. And he told us he wanted to do a Colgate Comedy Hour and the Sid Caesar Show, and he was going to recreate it in New York. On stage where they did it, and he was going to do live, and he was real smart. He when they offered him a pilot, he said, no, I want to do 7.
And he said, you were in?
No, not exactly. He said, I want to, you know, he's just telling me about the concept, and I'll call you. Then I did have to audition a couple of times. I was not accepted right away. I did have to audition, even though I knew him and I had a history. I think part of the problem was that Belushi and I had met. And we'd already formed, like, the Blues Brothers and
Where'd
some
you
other
meet?
Ideas. We met at my 505 club, the little speakeasy that I had.
You had a speakeasy?
I had an after-hours club in
Where?
Toronto.
In Toronto?
505 Queen Street East.
While you were driving the truck?
This is Second City time. He came over to Second City to raid us, to raid Gilda for Lampoon, and I met him that night. And we'd
cooked, John?
John.
Belushi.
And we'd cooked up, yep. We'd cooked up the Blues Brothers by the time we got to our Saturday Night Live auditions.
Did he know a lot about the Blues?
Not too much. He was more into heavy metal, but he was from Chicago. He had been to all the great places, had heard all the great artists, but he was more into heavy metal.
Well, hard rock at that time, I would
and
think.
And that
no?
stuff. Grand Funk and, he loved the, you know, Grand Funk and Cream and all that. But so Lauren was afraid that we already had the Blues Brothers concocted.
Well,
he didn't want a cabal. Lauren looked at the two of us and said, that's a power base that might be trouble there.
Now, you guys, though, like first going back to the Viking, when you drove to New
Orleans. And it was trouble.
Of course.
Immense trouble.
How could it not
Look, gray hairs on Lauren's head are probably single-handedly caused by John and I and maybe Chase.
Chase, yeah. I mean, he still causes gray hairs for people. But so when you go across country, you go to New Orleans and stuff, you're stopping in to see music? And is that part of the journey?
Sure. Jazz Fest, absolutely. Yeah. Rockin' Doopsie, man.
Love it, right?
Clifton Chenier. Oh, yeah. Bo Jacques, the great Zydeco players. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that stuff.
Professor Longhair.
Love that. Saw him many times.
Dr. John.
Saw him many times. Mm. Many times, yeah. Tipitina's Club. Yeah.
Yeah, you love it, right?
Oh, I love
it.
You been to New Orleans?
I've been there. I haven't done the music thing much.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so
yeah,
you and John, was it love at first sight, or how did that work?
That's it, pretty much, yeah. He walked in the back door. It was a blizzard night. It was the February night. You know, we were doing the set of Second City, and we were backstage there, and the door flew open, which directly accessed the alley there. And it was a step above the little pit where we were working in with our costumes and that. Yeah. And John appeared. He opened the door, and there was a silhouette there. And he had like a hexagonal driver's cap on, and he had a white cable knit sweater and a white scarf and a pack of cigarettes and a butt going, and you know, sneakers, totally underdressed for Canada.
Yeah.
And he came in, and of course that was, you know, and then he did the set. I think he hit the wall for us that night and everything.
He got on stage and did the riffing.
Oh yeah, yeah. He hit the wall for us, I think, that night. That was his famous thing of running from the front of the stage, hitting the wall, and then sliding down.
That was his famous thing.
Well, everybody did it. Everybody did it.
That was a bit. Sure.
That was a bit, yeah. And Tino and Santa did that. I mean, many people hit the wall.
Who were the, like, when in your recollection of Second City at that time, who were, like, the improvisers that you just, everybody was like, holy shit.
Oh, well, Murray.
Yeah.
Yeah. Murray. Oh, God. And Flaherty, Joe Flaherty. Oh, and Brian Murray, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Brian, you know, Bill's brother. Very funny.
What was it about Bill? Because he doesn't, like...
Danger, man, you know, high voltage, you know, the hurricane, wow, you never knew what was coming next, you know, it could be verbal, it could be physical, it could be, just beautiful, beautiful excitement.
What about Candy?
And Candy was lovely. He was a lovely improviser because he was so full of so much heart and soul and wild Dr. Tongue, you know, and then in Tino and Santa, his beautiful... friend and partner, you know. Oh, those were great times. Great, strong women, too, yeah.
Yeah, Gilda and... Mm-hmm.
Rosemary Radcliffe, Catherine O'Hara.
Oh, Catherine's so amazing.
Yeah,
man.
And Betty Thomas, who went on to direct directing Broadway Betty Thomas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was quite the crew. Were you involved in the Lampoon Hour as well?
You know what? I guessed it on a record produced by Chris Guest. I played drums, and I think I did a...
Was that the Lemmings record?
I think it was... No, it was another Lampoon record.
Okay.
Yeah. But you see, that's why John could come up to Toronto. And he did succeed in getting Gilda to go back down to New York to work on, Lemmings and work... And we'll work on Lampoon Radio and their records and that. But I didn't want to leave Toronto. I had a good racket going, man.
With
I had the 505 speakeasy. Because,
what was that?
Everything closes at 1 o'clock in Toronto, did at the time.
Yeah.
Where's a streetcar driver or a cop or a waiter or waitresses or somebody off duty? Where are they going to get a drink? Well, we supplied that for them. When we left, there was a wall high. There was just a wall of bottles that went up 7-8 feet high.
So you just were an all-cash business selling
all cash,
liquor?
Yeah, we did that. And then I had Second City. And then I had a radio business with Dave Thomas.
We were doing
radio. I didn't want to go. I had a radio commercial business with Dave Thomas. I was at Second City. And I was on an afternoon sitcom for kids called Coming Up Rosie. And I had the speakeasy. I had all these little hustles going. I didn't want to move. I was set up.
Yeah. You had a radio ad business, or it was almost
Radio ads. We wrote radio ads.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so companies would come to you and go...
That's right. Yeah, write us a 30, write us a 60. Yeah.
So for Canada, you were doing great.
Doing great. I was making more than the prime minister made one year, you know.
How old were you? 22, 21?
Right about that, yeah.
And so what eventually gets you to go to New York?
SNL, the final offer. Okay, you're in. So there was a wonderful actor and improviser named Ben Gordon, and I remember I had to pick something up at the fire hall where Second City ended up. And, and so I pulled up in my 1971 XOPP Harley Davidson FLH. With the saddlebags all packed, and I get in front of the building there, and Ben Gordon's there, my buddy, and, you know, he's like the last person to see me before I go off to SNL, and I wave to him, and I hit the highway. On the bike, and I'm riding down the highway, down highway over 90, then to highway 81, southbound on 81, and I'm driving along, and I'm thinking, wow, the future's ahead of me, this is wonderful, and I'm on the bike, and then I see a station wagon full of, like, a family passing me, you know, and they're passing me, and they're waving.
Yeah.
They're waving. Oh, yeah. Oh, and now, this is before I'm known or anything.
Yeah.
And then another car goes by. It's a young couple in a sports car.
Yeah.
And they're pointing at me and waving. Yeah. What the? And then in the third night, by the time I look back at my saddlebag, I'm full on fire back there. There's flames. I had an old chessboard, you know, in my chess set. It was a cardboard chest. It hit the muffler. It was burning off the muffler at a canvas saddlebag. And that thing, it looked like just rooster tail of flames. Like I looked like a rocket car.
Yeah.
So, geez, I pull over and a couple of bikers, they were from the Breed Motorcycle Club. I'll remember that because I wrote a paper on bikers in college. But
You did? What'd you write? What was that about?
Well, just the society.
The culture of it? Was it before? Well, no, because Hunter had already written Hell's Angels.
Well, then, and Eve Leving is a great reporter for for that there. But the Breed, they gave me some oil, and they hosed me down, and they sent me on my way. And then I pulled into Manhattan, or to the George Washington Bridge. It was about midnight. And I come across the George Washington Bridge, and all of my electrics cut out on the motorcycle.
On the Harley?
On the Harley. All of the electrics cut out. And there's no breakdown lane on the George Washington Bridge.
No.
There is no. You don't have a place to go.
No.
So I had to unwire the front, the headlight, and go out with pliers and a screwdriver and rewire the thing with transports whipping by. Oh, thanks. So I get into the city, and I don't know which way I'm going. I just take the first exit. I end up in the depths of Harlem. And one-way streets with people yelling, hey, one way, man, one way, one way. And I'm driving in front of me. Finally, I get downtown, and I get to a bar, and I see a bar in the West Village there, and there's all these beautiful Harleys all lined up. And I pull at the bar, and I'm back in, and I go in, and I look, and there's guys dressed exactly like me, black jeans, black, you know. Leather jacket with neckerchiefs hanging out of their pockets, different colored neckerchiefs. Coming, you know, I've got a red one there because for changing the oil. And I go in, and I have a beer, and, you know, and one of them says, police bike. And we're talking bikes and everything. Yeah. And then I say, I get some change. I call John, and I say, so, John, I'm down the street here at this bar. You know, and he says, what bar is that? That's the one on the corner with all the motorcycles. Yeah, that's the heavy metal gay biker bar of the city.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, well, I'm here and I'm in a beer and all. He says, so, well, come on over. And, you know, I look just like all those guys, you know. And in the end, Harley riders are Harley riders, man. We're just talking about bikes and stuff. And so that was my sort of first welcome into Manhattan.
Yeah. And so what? How did it shift that, you know, how did Lorne decide to put you on the show?
I think the basis of the audition tapes and some writing pieces and an appeal, a last-minute appeal from three people. And they would have not have, I would not have been on there if it weren't for the lobbying of Gilda Radner, Tom Davis, and Senator Al Franken. The three of them lobbied. They say, you got to have Aykroyd. They got to.
When you started, when I talked to Lorne, and I've talked to Al Franken several times as well, it seems like that, you know, it was sort of a very engaged ensemble of people in terms of the creative process. That first season was like just crazy, right? Staying up all night, working shit out.
We had a schedule. It was this, but I don't know if it's the same there now. I'll get to what I feel about the show now, and it's just nothing but enthusiasm and joy. It's been so great. But we, and Monday, we'd pitch the ideas. Tuesday, go away, think about them, write them. Wednesday, read them through, rewrite them Wednesday, then shoot them for blocking Thursday and Friday, then three shows on Saturday, basically, a dry run, dress rehearsal, and show. And the thing was, we just all gelled. There were frictions and everything, but we understood each other's humor, even though we came from different worlds, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just, we appreciated each other's gifts, you know? The brilliance of Schiller and Zweibel and Michael O'Donoghue.
Man. It's like that guy, like he blew my mind when I was young, because I was like 13 when you guys were doing that first season. You've got about 11 years on me. So like, it was really fucking with my head. And, you know, anything O'Donoghue would do, I'm like, what is this guy doing?
Precision writing. He taught me discipline in writing. He taught me precision and format and laying out beats, you know. He was really
But he was really like, his humor kind of cut deep and dark and out there, man, right?
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But you kind of do some of that stuff too. I remember like that stuff like landed in my head so hard that first season. Bass-o-matic. Was that first season?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that that's dark humor. That's
it's
just
not dark, but it's just like, how did that
letters.
Happen?
We got letters.
About the fish?
You can't put a fish. You can't do it. You know what? How could you do that to a fish? Well, the fact of the matter is, I was 10 years before. I was 13 years old. Yeah. I was at my aunt's house in Quebec there near Montreal. And my aunt was the Julia Child of Canada.
Oh, really?
Her name was Helene Goujon, and she had her own shop, her own radio show, TV show, cooking show. It was the first...
She's your aunt?
She was my aunt, yeah. She's deceased now. God, she's a wonderful woman. She brought the first Cuisinart into Canada. And so one night, we're sitting at her place on the river near Montreal there, and I see the blender going, and I see her pop a whole trout into the blender and hit the button. I said, Aunt Helen, what about the eyes, the head, the bones? Oh, it's a bouillabaisse. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's supposed to be in there. It's supposed to be in there. What? And that shot, I was, what? Whoa. So later, 10 years later,
they use everything.
They use, and she hit the blender, and the thing liquefied. So 10 years later, I'm with Lauren and Paul Simon and Chevy Chase, and we're having dinner at Elaine's. And, you know, and they say, well, you know, they're talking, oh, he's cooking that fish up there. And I said, I hope he uses a bass-o-matic, you know. Yeah. And what was, you know, and you know, yeah, that's where you put the, and bass-o-matic, somehow Paul, he laughed at that.
Yeah, yeah.
He laughed, and he was doubled over. I think he lost, like, you know, lost it. And I thought, wow, you know, Paul's one of the most brilliant people alive.
Yeah.
And if I can get a laugh like that out of Paul Simon, I'm writing this thing up.
Right.
So I wrote it up.
But it seemed like you guys were having a fucking great time.
We were. It was hard. It was video commando time. You know, there was a lot of stress. And, you know, it got to a point where I had to kind of get a little upset there. And I was, because we were writing the show, and then the card people couldn't keep up. Now, the show is red.
Yeah.
If you're going that fast, you have to have cue cards. And
they
were coming to me and saying, Dan, we can't take these pages from the writers at the last minute and put them up. They just won't get up there.
Yeah.
So I led a little revolution, and, you know, and we were able to slow that process down.
Let me ask you a question, though. Since you were the front, like the cards have always been red, and you know, why?
Because you're going fast, you're cutting five cameras, and you and the cameras cut on cue, they cut on words, and also you're moving fast, and you've got
not enough time to memorize shit. It doesn't help.
It helps to memorize, and people do memorize, and I memorize, but you know, when you got to go to the cards, they're there for you.
Yeah,
those guys and ladies, they're just heroes on SNL. They're beloved, and they're just, it's a Sharpie on a card, but boy. You know, if you're doing a rap that has to go fast, or if you're doing update or something, it's just a boon to have them. You know, teleprompters don't work because the card holders, they're human.
They have control. They can hear
they can
you.
Feel the rhythms. Right. They can see you set. They feel when you're going to get to the end of a line. And the card is whipped away. They can feel when you're approaching the top of the line. You're at the middle of the line. The card, it can be moved. They feel the rhythm of the whole piece, and they get that about the actors. Really a wonderful interplay and to make it happen.
But when you and like, it wasn't like you were on camera with Belushi a ton that first season or the first two seasons, right? But you guys were pals, right?
And
did you share a writing room, or did you share?
We shared a room with bunk beds and a couple of desks. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
We shared a writing room, and then I was living for almost the whole of the first year. Well, let me see, at least 4 months with John and Judy. So
yeah,
they let me stay at their place.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah,
she's still around, right?
Oh yes, Judy's my partner in Blues Brothers stuff. And
yeah,
she's in town here. Just saw her. Yeah.
And she's doing all right.
She's doing okay. Yeah, she's doing okay. I mean, you know, that was a tough thing. They were high school sweethearts.
I know, and it's so like when you guys are working together and you see the culture that's sort of happening there. With drugs and whatever, but you weren't that one in your bag, huh?
Well, I mean, back then the greenie was plentiful.
Yeah.
Right now, if we lit one up, I'd sneeze. The ironic thing is the terpenes that give it the taste is what I used to like about it. But if I would be sneezing here. You wouldn't believe that I'd be so loud.
The weed's too much now.
Well, I would. The terpenes have produced some allergy in me. Ironically, you know, because back then, never was. You know, back then it was. Kind of fuel the greenie, but never was into the coke or the powders or the pills. That wasn't my thing.
Booze?
I've never had a problem. I was always been able to moderate my alcohol consumption, and I am in that business now. I have a vodka line called Crystal Head Vodka.
The Skullhead.
The Skullhead, yeah. Now, my brilliant managing partner, Jonathan, he went to the Schulich School of Business at York University in Toronto. Wonderful, he said, you know, come on and go on Mark's show and talk about the head, talk about the head. Well, I'm not going to talk about the head. No, just to wind him up. Well, I will say that it's Crystal Head vodka. It's the zero additive vodka. If you want to have a vodka, it's the cleanest one on the planet. I know brown spirits are huge. Every bartender and bar chef uses brown spirits, but every bar has to have a vodka, and why not Crystal Head? You pay a little more for it, but it's only 32 cents more a shot. Here are the notes: sweet vanilla, dry, crisp, with a kick of heat off the finish. That's all I'll say. Moving on to aviation.
What's the foundation of the vodka? Is it a potato or a rye?
Well, so as you ask, we have a corn and sunset wheat.
Uh-huh.
What makes my vodka different is we don't add glycol, we don't add sugar. We don't add terpenes. We don't add any limonene at all.
Mm-hmm.
We just have the good old Newfoundland water, which comes from the glacier that melted into the province, and it's sitting underneath the province. And we have a pipe that goes down into a well, and up it comes. And it's just beautiful.
I didn't realize
vodka is a Russian word for water. So if we start with good water, we get there. Yeah.
I didn't realize you could make vodka almost out of anything.
You can. Grapes, dandelion, rice. Potato. Sure.
Yeah.
Turnips. But we like that. Our corn is it's called Peaches and Cream. That's the brand of corn.
Yeah.
So it's called the Peaches and Cream corn. It's nice and fat and
juicy. So you're really involved from the ground up here. You go to the place where they make it?
I've been twice. I've got to get back there. I've been traveling the world selling it for them.
In Newfoundland?
Yes, Newfoundland, Canada. The people there talk with a beautiful Irish accent. They're lovely, lovely people.
I've never been up there. Here it's beautiful.
It is spectacular.
Yeah.
And it's just a colorful, wonderful place. People walk down the street. They're not in their phones. They're holding hands. They're talking to each other.
Yeah.
So we felt that not only the water, but the love of the people. They make it. So I've traveled the world selling the thing. I have no problem. I'm able to consume safely, but I encourage anyone who does consume to do so moderately. You know, I mean, I make the best vodka out there, I believe, and Ducati believes they make the best motorcycle. Ducati makes a motorcycle that goes 200 miles an hour. I make a vodka that, sure, after 8 shots, you're not going to get a hangover, but I don't recommend drinking that much. You know,
is that clean?
Well, it is, because there's no glycol.
Yeah.
We're doing well with it. We're having fun, and we're meeting some neat people. And again, we are encouraging sobriety everywhere we go.
Well, that's a question. That's sort of a nice segue. Is like, you know, when you saw John starting to get out of control, was there just no stopping him? I mean, I'm a sober guy. I've been sober a long time, so I know the deal. Mm. But were there attempts made? Was it?
Many. We flushed a lot of coke down the toilet. We intervened, but he'd wriggle away from us, and
all through it.
When? It started basically in the. The first year of the show, but he'd been exposed to it before. That was the currency of the generation.
Yeah,
back
sure.
Then.
No, I get it. Yeah,
it was the blow was the currency of the generation.
Yeah,
and a lot of people were on it, and
he loved it.
And he did. That was what kind of got him going. And and he just had the addictive personality. And
so it's a prolonged heartbreak.
I think of him all the time, especially when I go into a house of blues. I think of him all the time because here we built these beautiful blues palaces for music and fun, and he's not.
How many
are
there still around?
There's 13
still.
Yep. It's owned by Live Nation, the great concert company, and
that was the first big. That was a huge business thing for you.
Well, I learned a lot.
Like you've always been a business dude.
Well, I tell you, you know, you go into show business, even at Second City, going to the cabaret or working for CBC.
Yeah.
You have to negotiate your deals. You have to know your value.
Yeah.
You have to manage the money when it comes in. I've always, it's show business. So I've been in show business a long time, and it is a business. You know, you broker your talent, you work with an agent, a broker, and you put the product out there and sell it. It's kind of, my dad worked for the government. He did not have a business sense in terms of doing that.
But it seems like you always did. You were running a speakeasy for cops and after hours.
That was beautiful, man. The 505. It's still there, 505 Queen Street East.
Yeah.
What a spot.
It's still a speakeasy?
No, I think some lawyers are in there now.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, but it just seems like, with the House of Blues deal and sort of the vodka deal, that you like making the deals. You like doing the thing.
I enjoy with the people that I work with because of the creativity, how smart they are. The crews, like the House of Blues staff, man, they're amazing. They love working there. And then these creative people I was involved with Tigret and all the people that founded it. And then the fun of going to, for instance, the House of Blues in Vegas with the greatest view of the Strip at the Foundation Room at the Mandalay Bay.
Sure.
Going there, hanging there, ordering a vodka, having 50 people for dinner, friends and partners, and thinking, wow, I mean, didn't Elvis live like this? Uh-huh. Didn't Frank Sinatra live like this? You know, staying up till 3 a.m, yeah. going to shows, playing shows, playing a concert with Jimmy and going upstairs and partying at the 3 a.m. at the yeah. nightclub that we have an ownership in, yeah. you know, drinking fluid that we're making. Wow, how grateful I am. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great. You have a great life.
I was most certainly, we all do living in the Western world. We
sure.
kind of born in the
lottery.
Weren't
you living out in Nantucket for a while?
Martha's Vineyard. Vineyard. That's my primary residence
there?
U.S. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I see my dad a lot in Canada because he's 98, as I yeah. said. But
you love the vineyard.
Love the vineyard. Love the vineyard. That's great. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like its own ecosystem out there. Its own world.
I love the Northeast. I love the history in Boston. I love.
The terrain up there is pretty.
Yeah, no, yeah. it's beautiful. Love the coast.
Coastline. Up into Maine, even. It's great.
Beautiful place.
So you're on, you did SNL for like 4 or 5 years.
Four years, 74 to 75. And then we wrote the Blues Brothers, and we had to leave to complete the Blues Brothers.
So John was there that long too?
Yes, yeah, 74, 75. Well, he left to do Animal House, so he was there gone for a few months. And Lorne, you know, John left to do Animal House. They offered yeah. me the part of D-Day,
yeah.
and I just couldn't leave. Ultimately, I couldn't leave Lorne shorthanded short of a writer and yeah. short of a. I knew that he didn't want me to go in the worst way, and I yeah. knew it would hurt the Enterprise a bit. And I knew I made the right decision there. I knew.
Well, it was nice. Did Lorne appreciate that?
All the time, man. To this day, absolutely. Yeah. yeah. yeah.
So you and John put together the Blues Brothers.
We did, and we couldn't stay at the show then because we were shooting. The shooting went over into the fall
for the first movie.
And then we went over into the you know, kind of fall, and then you know, kind of winter into the. So we had to be in L.A. and it just was time to leave. You know.
And that was huge, right?
The Blues Brothers did okay. It was a box office hit and went on to, I think, some people credit it with reviving the careers of these great artists.
Who, for Steve me, and Duck and Matt Guitar Murphy?
And Aretha and Ray, who were recording and performing. But sure. it helped boost it with an audience that might have been less familiar, I think.
Was Cab Calloway in it?
Cab Calloway and James Brown became one of my best friends. Yeah. I mean, or I I don't know if he thought that about me, but yeah. I certainly thought that about him. He opened 5 nightclubs with us, and uh-huh. He did 3 movies with me, Dr. Detroit, the first Blues Brothers on the second.
So you were able to have a real relationship with
that guy. I went to his birthday party in Augusta, Georgia, and hung with him many times.
So once John was out here and you kind of went your own way.
Well, John died in 82
right.
after the movie. So that was kind of a blow, and I didn't know what to do with that. But I managed to, you know, pick things up. And
I remember the picture of you
the writing
leading the procession.
Right, right.
On the bike.
Yeah, that had to be done. I mean, it had to be.
That was such a
powerful. John loved Harleys. He loved riding together. So, yeah. yeah and,
it's you know, a powerful it, image, dude.
Sure, sure. That was a tough day. Tough day for sure.
Yeah.
You know, he was 33.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And when I do Born in Chicago now, I sing the old Nick Gravanitis, Paul Butterfield tune.
I love that song.
I sing that song and I say, and my second friend went down when he was 33 years of age. And the one thing you can say about that boy, he made the front page.
Yeah.
And he was on all the front pages. I had to run from our office where I was working on Ghostbusters and typing a line of his. And I get the call from Bernie Brillstein that he was gone, and I had to run. I remember it was a brilliant March day, severe clear, like yeah. they say in aviation, and I ran. And there was the news. It was just hitting the newsstands. I had to run to Judy to let her know before anybody else did. That was a long run. I ran down from 5th Avenue and 23rd Street all the way down
to
Morton Street. No, I walked in. She was just getting breakfast, and I had to tell her.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess
kind of Leo, you know, sort of, oh, no, we all sort of, if he knew it, we knew he was kept going, it might go like that. But there was always a hope that he would, you know.
Yeah, probably.
I think if he was alive today, he'd be a director on Broadway. He'd be doing theater.
Yeah.
He'd have a production, theater production company. He'd be doing all kinds of stuff, you know, back to the, you know, the work of the hard, nitty-gritty actor, you know, because he loved that.
I was in college, my freshman year of college when it happened. I was devastated. I loved the guy. I didn't know him, but I was a big fan.
Oh, it was fun. We went up to Boston once to sell the record, the Saturday Night Live record. Yeah. We went on radio and that. And
yeah.
We're driving around the town. We pull over to a a corner, and there's an elementary school there, yeah. Like four-story elementary school. And,
yeah.
And John gets out, and he goes to the front window, you know, and
yeah.
And starts doing, you know, stuff. And people start recognizing him, and then second floor, third floor, fourth floor. He had the whole school screaming at him by the time we left the place, you know.
Yeah.
And his performance in Animal House is outstanding.
It's great.
And his performance in the Blues Brothers is meticulous. When he says to the guy at Bob's Country Bunker, yeah. Of course we'll be paying for those beers. I usually sit in the car and write the check out on the dashboard. You know, I will be right back. You know, he's just a master comedian. Yeah, and to get to know him and be with him for 8 years, what a privilege and a pleasure
that
and
scene
an honor.
With Carrie Fisher in the tunnel?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
We lost her, too. That yeah. that was a complete shock. What a brilliant, wonderful person.
Yeah. Oh, you used to be together, kind of.
We were going to get married. We had blood tests, rings, the whole thing. And we fell deeply in love. And then, you know, then we left the Blues Brothers set and we took a Learjet.
Yeah.
John and Judy and Carrie and I. And we flew to Martha's Vineyard in the middle of the night. And I was going to show Carrie the home where we were going to live forever. Yeah. This is where we're going to live. I just bought this. I told Judy, just buy me a house there. Yeah. I don't care if it's on the ocean, just as long as it has nice views.
Yeah.
So Judy said, I found a house. Yeah. It's not quite vineyard style. It's not Cape Cod. So we pull up to this house in the middle of the night, you know.
Yeah.
And there's Carrie, and I'm sort of almost Carrie over the threshold.
Yeah.
Don't take it. But we get inside, and it's all kind of, it looks like Fred Flintstone's cousin built it. It's got, you know, stone fireplaces, but fine. And then all this modern kind of Eames furniture and stuff. And I don't know, it just struck her as wrong,
right,
you know.
Right.
And I said, well, apparently there's a beautiful view. And the night went badly. And the next morning I hear her on the phone with Paul Simon, and she said, I got to go back to Paul. I got to go. So I drive her to the airport. I wake her up at 9:30 in the morning. She wakes me up, and I get in the Jeep, you know, and it's fog is set in around this house. And so I drive her to the airport, and finally the fog clears and the plane's able to take off. She says, oh, it was great. Thank you. I'll call you. We'll be in, you know. She flies back to New York to Paul, who, you know, she was with after that.
Paul Simon.
Yeah. And I go back, and I loved her, and I'm a little brokenhearted, but it's kind of, maybe this is best for her and all of us.
Yeah.
And I drive back in the Jeep to the vineyard house. And by now the fog has lifted, and I get to the top of the hill, and I find out that it's a 1959 Usonian house designed by Hideo Sasaki. It's a beautiful, glass paneled walls.
Uh-huh.
And it looks out over the Sound, and there's a 100-mile view, and
yeah.
you can see the sea from everywhere, from five different angles.
Yeah.
And I thought, boy, if she'd seen this view, I don't think she would have left in the morning. We might have gotten married, you know?
Yeah. Is that the house you still have?
Yeah, yeah. I live there. You know, when I can get to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my daughters own it. They own everything now. I've given everything to
them. Oh, really?
Children. Oh, of course.
How old are they?
I've got a daughter, Danielle. She records and performs and is a writer and performer. And then I have a daughter, Belle, and I've got a daughter, Stelly, who's my writing partner.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you still seem to, you show up in things, and, you know, the Ghostbuster franchise is still kicking.
Yes, they haven't shown me a thing because, you know, they know I'll talk about it.
The third one?
Yeah, yeah. They haven't. I'm saying, show me some stuff. No, because they know I'm going to be bragging about it. But we're getting excellent feedback from those who have seen it.
Yeah.
And who are.
What's your involvement in it? Just as a producer, or how does that work?
I was, let's say, major cheerleader because it's the old family franchise.
Sure.
I suggested some ideas to Jason.
Yeah.
And I did a little writing on it, but it was basically
him. Did Jason direct the last one?
No. No, that was Paul Feig.
Feig, right.
Yeah. The women's movie was really funny and really good, and some great ghosts and a great villain in the end with the red bow tie. I just should have been watching the Dollars and Cents more as a producer. But in this one, we did watch the Dollars and Cents.
What's the angle on this one?
And this one transfers the DNA of the first two movies to the third group, and Jason's written in, and it's really, really good, Jason and Bill. And so I showed up to play a part. He wrote up some scenes in there, which helped feed the story, so I agreed to...
Now, Jason, is he someone that you saw grow up from being a little baby?
He was on the set. Yeah, he was on the... He's in the second movie.
Yeah.
He's the one who gives us... He gives a shit at the party, the birthday party.
Yeah, I've talked to him and Ivan. I talked to Ivan.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nice. So, after SNL and you do, you know, the big hit was like, it was Trading Places, really, right? I mean, that was a huge...
Well, I think that, you know, the
I love Neighbors, by the way.
Yeah, that was a Thomas Berger book that was adapted,
yeah.
And John Apted and I kind of turned it into a screenplay, and there's some neat, bizarre stuff in there. We should have, I don't know, we switched parts. Maybe we should have just kept the
parts. It was just an odd movie.
It was odd. The book was odd, but yeah. I think that character and John's character, he was so funny and cute in that. Would it have made more money and done better had we switched parts back?
Yeah.
And if I'd been the villain, if I'd been the meek guy and he'd been the villain, I don't know. Trading Places, great collaboration with Eddie Murphy, and then we had the Ghostbusters movies and
sure,
Spies now. Like Us, which was a wonderful collaboration with Chevy and with my wife Donna.
Did you always like Chevy?
Oh, yeah. So I love Chevy. Chevy and I, when we first met in New York, got on tremendously. I loved him. He was so funny, and he was my biggest supporter, man. He just kind of got what I was doing, and you know, he was always lobbying for me and was behind what I was up to.
He
was very, very, he was an ally of mine.
That's great.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
Because there was a weird, like, I was there bad blood when he left after the first season?
Nobody wanted him to go,
right.
Because he was a big star on the show. We felt that might hurt us.
Yeah.
Maybe there were some personnel that were happy he left, but yeah. I think that he left too early. I'm sorry he left. Now I'm even sorry he left. We'd have had fun, but what did it get us? Murray came on then.
Yeah.
You see.
Murray, and you knew him from
back. Oh, man. We were from the day one, from when I got hired.
Yeah.
It was like, can we bring Murray too?
Yeah.
And Murray was introduced me to in Second City. He was my chaperone when I went there. And Billy, so he came on, and then look at the work he did.
Are you still friends?
I hope so. No. We are. We saw each other on the set, GB there. And we're as close as brothers can be.
Yeah.
I guess. And brothers can sometimes drift and be close, but there's never been a major rift with us.
It seems like your relationship with the SNL is not only nostalgic, but you seem to keep up with it all the way through.
Yeah.
What do you think of the show now?
I love it. I think it's really
great. Because you said you wanted to talk about that.
Really great. Yeah, Kate McKinnon as the devil.
That was great.
That was the double over. How the writing is really, really sharp. Of course, they've got a lot to write about now. Yeah. I love the cast members now. They're really outstanding. They did Eddie was on there, and they did a spectacular scene. The cake making contest.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yeah, it was very funny.
I mean, really funny.
Yeah.
All funny. It's just terrific.
Yeah, it seems like it goes up and down. It was so funny because when I interviewed Lorne, I had this weird, agenda because I had gotten as far in the audition process for SNL as to meet with him, and then I did not get the gig many years ago.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted closure on that, and he was nice enough to walk me through what he believes might have happened then, which was great. But also he brought it to my attention, and I think a lot of people do at my age, where I said, because your season, the first season or the first couple, it's sort of mythological. Like, it has a mythic presence. But in his mind, as a guy who's been walking those halls for 40 years or whatever, and it's like, that was a good one, but we've had other good ones. Like,
he's right there with them. I would say, he's right there today, feeling the same way he did about most affectionately and admirably about all. He loves all his children equally.
You think so?
I do.
And what about the environment?
All the way through. Every year, there's something there that is salvageable for him, and now he's on a real triumph with this magnificent cast
that's
that
he's crazy,
got
right?
And the writing.
Do you talk to him?
I spoke to him. I was supposed to go in and do something there, but I had another thing that couldn't make it out. Couldn't get out of it.
Yeah, but you guys are good.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And that environment that everyone talks about, either you can cut it or you can't.
It's pretty competitive and
it always
immediate.
Was?
Yes. Yes, it always was. But in the end we all pulled together as a team and that's what makes it work,
Cuz yeah. There aren't that many dissenters. Oddly, I haven't talked to some people have chips on their shoulders, but most of the people that survive SNL think it was one of the greatest experiences of their life.
Well, I sure must say so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did you figure out that you might have the Asperger's?
Oh, that's self-diagnosed. I don't know. I've never really gone to a medical professional
about it.
I think that's probably more I don't know, some early trauma producing like Tourette's-like symptoms.
You had that, right?
I had some early trauma. I had some trauma in elementary school with a particularly abusive teacher.
Really?
I think that set me to where I got, you know, I do, you know.
Did you tell your parents about it?
They sent me to a psychologist. I was in therapy between the ages of, 10 to 15.
What was the trauma?
A physical abuse with a ruler.
Oh.
Pointer.
Uh-huh.
Knuckles.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
For every day at school?
Mostly. Mm-hmm.
Catholic school?
Well, yes, it was.
Hmm. And you feel that triggered the...
It may have, yeah, because I got tics and I got, you know, and the barkings and
no
kind
kidding.
Of... Yeah. And it really set me off. And you know, I was a quirky little kid.
Yeah, already. What were the beatings for? Was he doing it to other kids?
I won't say whether it was male or female. No. I was the one that was picked that year, yeah.
Holy shit. Yeah. So, and then you went to therapy and you...
Going to that school, the old story, when I was a kid, I used to have to walk 3 miles through the snow to get to school. Well, guess what? I did. I was 7, 8 years old. My mother would set me out the door.
Yeah.
At 7, 8 years old, I would go out the back door into the woods, into the Gatineau Park.
Yeah.
Go down a path.
Yeah.
Where the timber wolves were howling.
Yeah.
In a half mile away, go up under the hydro lines, down this steep, steep rocky cliff to a creek that was there, and that creek was one that my dad, as the engineer, had built for drainage. And I said, can you put a bridge there? He said, we'll put a bridge, but not where you cross. It'll be where most people cross. So he did put a bridge there, but it was too far to walk.
Right.
So I go down in the snow, and then I'd try to get across, and there was always like a board or something. Inevitably, I'd fallen into my waist.
Yeah.
Then I'd go across this busy highway, up into the neighborhood where the French-Canadian kids picked on me because I was English. They'd try to grab my books. They'd try to attack me. By the time I got to school, I was soaking wet, traumatized, and then I get in class, and this person goes after me physically.
Wow. Not a good day. Every day, a shitty day.
It was bad in that one grade, that one year, yeah.
So
terrible. But diagnosis, that's my own diagnosis. I got a lot of other things. I definitely know that I'm a heterochromiac syndactylite.
What is that?
I know for sure.
What is it?
That is a person with two different colored eyes and webbed toes.
Oh, you have the webbed toes.
I'm one. There's 7 billion of us on the planet now. I think there's two of us, Two that have both those things.
Oh, really?
Do you know
the other guy?
I don't know. I wish I could.
It's just two people became priests out of 5,000 at the elementary school, and then two people get the wet toes and the weird eyes.
I know that I'm that.
Well, that's special.
I know that I'm that, yeah.
What else do you know?
I don't know. What else? Diseases? I guess I'm pretty clear.
You're doing
otherwise.
Good? Oh, good. Yeah. So now getting through, like, you know, talking about, you know, spiritualism, what kind of gets you through the environment we live on now? It seems like you're awfully busy and you got a busy brain and you're interested in a lot of stuff.
I'm trying to be as loving as I can to my fellow human being. And I'm trying to recognize that every human I meet, even if it's just, you know, getting a burger across, in In-N-Out, that's a person with feelings and with, senses, and that there's something going on in their lives. And if I can make a pleasant moment for that person, sometimes I get people come up with selfies and that.
Yeah.
How can I turn that down? That's like, you know, this is a moment I want them to remember and go away with a pleasant thing. What's going on in their life? I want to be treated that way. That's a great Christian value. Be treated as you wish you should be treated. And, you know, I try to live my life that way. I'm not a perfect man. I'm a deeply, deeply flawed human being. However, I think I'm on the right side of most issues morally and spiritually. And I look to not necessarily God, but I look to the cosmic engineer.
Uh-huh.
I do sometimes cast my eyes to the sky and say, oh, Lord, can I get some help here?
Yeah.
I believe that we can all call upon that as universal energy. Just open your top of your head to it and say, I just need a little inspiration, a little help. Mm. I'm going through a lot.
Yeah.
Power of the universe, visit me. You know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm at in terms of, you know, a spiritual pursuit. Mm. I don't think formal religion has done us well And so I'm a severely lapsed Catholic.
Sure, right, mixing it up.
But fascinated with the Vatican, of course, and Rome. Ooh, and the two popes.
The deep magic.
The new pope and the, yeah.
The deep dark magic.
I went in there. It was one of the most frightening places
ever. Dude, there's a lot of dead wizards around.
Massive.
A lot of
pictures
dead wizards.
Of the popes. And I'm thinking, I'm a peasant. It's 1598. Yeah. I'm going in. I'm bringing my grain in.
Yeah.
I'll bring more grain next year.
No, that's exactly it. I've said the same thing. You visit those cathedrals, you look up and you're like, oh my God. It's like, how's that not going to brain fuck you into believing? Those, the design of all...
Vatican's the king daddy place of it all.
Yeah, I know, but like any of those churches in Italy, dude, any of them.
Yeah.
They're all mind-blowing.
Beautiful, beautiful,
and
yes,
just littered with the magical corpses.
Yeah.
And bits and pieces of people.
Yeah,
relics.
Sure. Yeah.
There's full-on witchcraft in that religion all the time.
Oh, no doubt, absolutely. It's all, it's hoochie-boochie, it's myth
hoochie-boochie.
And dogma.
What are my presents? Are these my presents?
Yeah, I got a, this is a Ray Stantz Ghostbusters doll.
Oh, thank you.
And it's a real cute one.
Okay, thank you.
That's a
great.
Neat diddle. Yeah.
I love it.
And then, I don't know, is this, I shouldn't give this to you because it's plastic.
That's all right.
But
what does that mean?
But it is, it's a Stay Puffed water
bottle. Oh, that's great, water
bottle. That you can put ice cubes in.
Oh, thank
but
you.
But nobody, I mean...
What are we going to do about plastic?
What are we going to do about plastic? Here's
your dad's
my family book. Business. And if you do play a record from time to time, I got an artist named Vera Sola, V-E-R-A-S-O-L-A. She's a protest singer, I could call her. And she's written a song about the extinction of the black rhino. And it's called Black Rhino Enterprises. And I know it's on Spotify. It's on Apple.
Oh, check it out.
Black Rhino Enterprises. And all her music on Spotify and Apple. Really powerful songwriter, crunch guitar composer, Vera Sola, V-E-R-A-S-O-L-A. Big fan of hers.
Great. I'll check that out. And you consider the history of ghosts. This is the family business.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Mediumship through the ages. Yeah.
Is there?
I'm not gifted. I'm not a medium. I've never channeled.
You are. I've seen you do 12. This
I've never channeled
voices.
A thing except digestively. So
no, you've channeled things. You channel things all the time. Now, but that's the question. You see how versatile you are at moving through voices and feeling beings within you, even though they're popular beings that we've all grown to love through other mediums and their impressions. But is there an element of hucksterism in this? In this pursuit,
it's pointed out in the book. All the fakes are in there too. Okay. All the hoaxes, all the fakes.
Okay.
Sometimes what happened is, you know, you'd have a very gifted medium like Eusapia Palladino. She produced ectoplasm, but then later in her life, her gifts left her, and she had to fake it.
Produced ectoplasm.
She did.
What does that mean?
It's in the book there.
Yeah.
It's kind of a mucus viscous substance. It's like.
Psychic
snot. And in fact, I can tell you, no one knew what ectoplasm was before Ghostbusters 1.
Yeah.
We educated the world there. Millions of people now know what ectoplasm is now because of Ghostbusters 1. And we're going to get into it again in the third movie.
All right. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me up in the tower here.
Yeah,
beautiful.
Man. Now we got to get down. Let me call the guy.
Okay, you know what? Next time, let's do it in the silo.
You know, for sure. I'll meet you there.
I'd love it, man. I'll rocket car in.
Okay, beautiful.
Take care.
Okay, so that was me and Dan Aykroyd. Again, you know, Crystal Head Vodka is available. And he's also going to be in the upcoming Ghostbusters Afterlife as Ray Stantz again. Call your friends, check in with your family, stay connected to somebody other than just the information on your phone. Reach out if you're feeling too isolated and too up into your own shit, or the darkness is closing in on you, yet you're still well. Reach out, man. Talk to a friend. Okay? I will now play three chords on my Les Paul Jr. through my 53 Fender Deluxe Amp, 1960 Les Paul Jr. Pretty well cranked. And I'll talk to you Thursday. Boomer lives.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.